So, actually, given that we are starting to narrow down to allied troops, maybe let me make sure who has not seen those things before? Who has seen those things before? I have this tendency to ask negative questions. Kind of, but it's not quite obvious. Okay, no, then maybe I'm not wasting my time today, because if I knew that I can start going quicker, I would prepare more material. But okay. So let us briefly recall where the motivation comes from. I wrote all those equivalences that you don't have to parse yet, but I was trying to suggest that they are meant to propagate that they are meant to describe somehow inductively or recursively the working of most of the connectives in terms of just this next step for every immediate successor or for some immediate successor relation. And as I said, it seems that somehow, in a certain sense of being defined, other connectives can be defined using this strange kind of equations, even this is not exactly the kind of definition or equivalence that we're talking so far. Maybe we need to make this idea more precise. So this is redundant. This actually we can leave out and just keep S here only. So as I said, we want to have a way to solve systems of equations of a certain kind, and that I left it a bit vague. Or more than a bit vague. What I exactly meant by this? I was just hinting that it will have to do in the end, right now, with computing denotations of formulas on a model, which is really the whole point of doing model checking algorithms. But in fact, the basic mathematics that I want to talk about will be applicable in much broader context. So this is a bit vague introduction. And let me now make more precise what I want to talk about. So before we continue, I want to tell you a few words mathematically about fixed points. And it is going to be useful not only for model checking, it will be also useful later in semantics of programming languages. So this is why I feel excused to scare you with a bit more mathematics and blackboard derivations. But this is very simple mathematics. It's not going below undergraduate level in discrete math, let's say. So first of all, recall the concept of pre-order or quasi-order. Who knows what it is? Really? You haven't seen this name? Pre-order, quasi-order, wie sagt man das auf Deutsch? So one can see both names being used in the literature. They are not introduced in Gloin. They are not. Okay, so this is just a reflexive and transitive relation, okay? So there's something that you have seen, even if you didn't see the name, you have seen it and you work with it. Is this clear what this means? So, okay, maybe let's start with absolute. Sorry? Halbordnung. Das kann sein. I can only take word for this. Okay, so let us recall first of all what is a relation, and this is something that we have already said. So let W or S be an asset. Let's start with W. So let W be any set a relation on it. This we know, right? Cartesian product, and I think I already said it twice during this lecture. So what it means for this thing to be reflexive? This must have been glowing. And for all V, V is in this relation, V is in this relation with itself, right? So another way, of writing this is that this pair V V belongs to this, but this looks a bit funny, right? Anyway, said theoretically, this is what the relation is. Transitive. Who can help me? What shall I write? You have seen the definition of transitive relation. Yes?
Well, if W is related to V and V is related to U, it implies that V is related to U.
So there are many situations in which such relations arise in nature. I'm tempted for those of you who attend the mathematics, I can even point out that the important subclass of topologies, Alexandrov topologies, is yet another way of seeing them. But let's start with something much more elemental, with much more obvious description. And we have, moreover, the notion of partial order, which is pre-order or quasi-order, which also happens to be anti-symmetric. Is this notion clear? So, anti-symmetry means that if you have this, and if you have this, then you also have that. Then you already have the W is 2. Okay, just a mathematical definition like any other. There are some other variants of this notion, like asymmetry, where you say that it cannot be the case that this and this hold at the same time. So asymmetry is like strict version of this weak ordering. So sometimes this can be a so-called weak partial order, because this also, as I said, we have that every element is comparable with itself. And sometimes what is that name that is also used is when you're thinking about both the underlying set, the domain or the Carrier set, and the relation, you call it, and a partial relation, you call the whole thing, this tuple, a poset, partially ordered set. So whether it's square order, why do you look so strange?
A pre-order is a partial order, if it's symmetric, not the other one.
Oh, of course, sorry. I should correct it right now already. Yes. What I was thinking. Yes, so a pre-order is a partial order if it's anti-symmetric. So, or a partial order is a pre-order which is anti-symmetric. One of those two, but I combine it into, yeah. Sorry. Now I understand why everybody was looking puzzled. Good. So, I should have asked you myself for some examples. So, but the first obvious one is when you take any kind of numbers. Natural, integers, rational, reals. And you take natural ordering, smaller, less or equal to. And notice that we can turn it upside down. Right? So given any poset, We can even write it as a fiore. Well, this is pompous to call it fiore. Fact. For any posset its converse or its opposite defined as is also a posset. Why does this hold? Reflexivity does not care about the direction either way. Transitivity, well, into flip it, and antisymmetry again is perfect. I mean, the statement of antisymmetry is in a sense symmetric in those two arguments or parameters. And this is something that is quite useful. A more interesting example is divisibility ordering on natural numbers. So we can say that m divides n if there exists k such that m times k is equal to n. Why is it reflexive? Again, the answer is one word. Yes? Yes, one. K equal to 1, okay, so maybe 3 words. That's the answer why this is reflexive. For transitivity, well, you probably see already how it works, but if we have that M divides N and N divides O, this means that M, there exists K1 such that M times K1 is equal to N, and exists K2 such that M times n times k2 is equal to O, and therefore we need to relate M and O, right? So we can substitute for this N here, we can substitute this thing. And we get that n, that O is equal to n times k2, but n is equal to n times k1. And what we can do now? Use associativity. This associativity of implication. So we got now some number such that m multiplied by this number is equal to O. Right? And, well, actually, the antisymmetry is also fun. So, antisymmetry. Sometimes people are using weak antisymmetry for antisymmetry and strong antisymmetry for asymmetry to make things a little more confusing. Anyway, so we want to show now that if M divides N and N divides M, then M must be equal to N, right? So this is what we wanted to show here. Here we wanted to show that these two things taken together, I don't have space now. This and this imply that M divides O, and we have shown it. So this means that for some K1, M times K1 is equal to N. This means that for some K2, N times K2 is equal to M. And again, we substitute, we get that m times k1 times, sorry, m times m times k1, sorry, we substitute this thing for here. So m times k1 times k2 is equal to m. Again, we use associativity. And now we use the fact that we are in natural numbers, right? We are not in rationals, for example, we are not in reals. So if m is distinct than zero at least, okay, so being zero is another thing that one has to be careful about, also in the definition of this divisibility ordering, because otherwise we will obtain quite different types of order. We can see this later. But if m is non-zero, the only k1, the only number which gives you this must be 1 itself. And if we are in natural numbers, the only way where that the multiple of two natural numbers is equal to 1 is when k1 and k2 are both 1. So this yields that m is equal to n. But this these are typical examples, but not examples that we need most today. The one that we really care about is this. So given any set, we can simply equip the power set with the inclusion relation. And inclusion relation is again a partial order. So I'm not sure if we need to write it even, but I hope that this was done somewhere in Gloin, for example, or in some other lecture. But we want to know that for any A, we have that A is containing A containing B, and B containing C means that A is containing C, and A containing B and B containing A means that A is equal to A. B is equal to A, sorry. This is all clear, right? I don't need to show this. Good, so we have many examples of partial orders. Another one that we don't need here, not in model checking, but which can be useful later in doing semantics of programming languages, is partial functions, again, with natural order. So in a sense, this example boils down to the previous one. When you think of partial function as its graph. So partial functions are a special type of relations. And in general, another type of relation, any other type of subsets of the Cartesian power of a given set. Now, by the way, I'm switching here from W to S, sorry. So, one interesting thing about being a preorder or a poset is that you are stable under relativization or substructure. What I mean by this is that if you have a poset, oh, sorry, this should be this square bracket again, and or a preorder set, and we take any subset of this Carrier set or of the domain. It's one and the same thing. We could then relativize the partial ordering to this smaller domain, and we obtain partial order or a preorder again. So if we think, for example, about natural numbers as subsets of rational numbers, this is how ordering on natural numbers can be obtained. This is a very trivial example, but let's say that we pick an interesting family of subset of S, for example, only the finite subsets. Again, you can relativize the inclusion relation just to inclusion between finite subsets. So we have another poset with perhaps slightly different properties than the entire power set. Yeah, actually, this is the next thing that I wanted to say. And, well, partial functions, again, this is what I should, this is what I already said on the previous slide. You can see this particular example of partial functions as a special type of subset, special types of subsets of the Cartesian product of R, of S or W, and the inclusion order on or specialization order on partial function can be seen as a relativization of the inclusion order on relations. Okay, but as I said, the only really important one for us at the moment is this inclusion relation. And now we have the notion of least upper bound, which is also sometimes called supremum and is sometimes called the join. Quite often, most of the time, you probably see not this square notation, but vetch and v in LaTeX. And greatest lower bound, which is also infimum, which is also called infimum or mid. Who has seen this notion before? Okay, let's go slow. So before we define what greatest lower or least upper bound mean, we first need to define what the bound is at all. So given so let's try to stick to S, but maybe I will switch to W several times. Let W be a poset. And now we can slowly switch talking just about posets rather than the more general case of pre-order or quasi-order sets. And let S be just be any subset of its domain. And we say that Y is an upper bound, and so this should be small y. Let's keep capital letters for sets and small letters for its elements. An upper bound of S if for any S in S we have that Y is we have that S is below Y. Notation Is it clear? So, for example, in real numbers or in rational numbers, can you give me any? Can you give me some examples of upper bound of this interval, the standard ordering? Any. You have your choice. Example, upper bound of this thing. Of the inter, maybe let me make clear if the notation is unclear whether this is a tuple or interval, so let's write it clearly. Of interval. So you know what it is, right? So all the numbers strictly contained between 0 and 1, not 0 and 1 itself. An example of an upper bound, come on. Yes? Well, that's a very good one. Something worse than that? Yeah, 2, 1.5, whatever, p, e, what have you. Right. And lower bound is defined dually. Right? So, a lower, okay, maybe to get a bit better picture, let's just think of different example than numbers. So, let's think about subsets or power set example. Can you give me any upper bound of these two sets? Let's say that our, maybe let me make it clear that our S, the underlying domain, consists of A, B, C, D. So in the power set of this A, B, C, D, an example of upper bound of this two guy. Well, the whole thing, for example, right? A, B, C, D. This is an upper bound of this, and in inclusion order, and an upper bound of this thing. Do I need to take the whole thing, A, B, C, D? Is there something smaller that does the job? Yes? Yes, exactly. A, C, D. Okay, so we get the point. Aha, and what is then greatest lower bound? Or least upper bound? So here in this case we're talking about upper bound. So let's least upper bound is then upper bound, which is least among all upper bounds. So if we, I'm not sure if it makes sense to write definition because the name says what it is. So for any other upper bound y prime, we have that y is below y prime. So in this case, least upper bound is ACD. And in this case, least upper bound was, of course, 1. So if we have a poset where every pair of elements, so in this case, for here we have family of sets, so a pair of elements is family of sets like this, where every pair of elements has its least upper bound is called joint semilattice. And where if every pair of elements has its greatest lower bound or mid or infimum is called mid semilattice, of course. And if you are both joint semilattice and a mid semilattice, we have a lattice. So maybe let me draw a few examples of poset, and you will tell me which one of those is a lattice and one which one isn't. for complex samples. So this straight line depicts, of course, our ordering. And I'm not drawing, I don't know, reflexive loops or anything that corresponds to transitive, which can be obtained by transitivity. This kind of thing is sometimes called Hasse diagram of a lattice. Maybe let's even give names to some of those things. So A, B, C, D, A, B, C, B, A, B, C, D, E, F. Aha, now I have letters for both counterexamples and names of points. So maybe let's call it 1, 2, 3, and 4. So is 1 a lattice? Okay, maybe let's wait a second. Okay, everybody has copied it, so now we can look at the blackboard. Is one a lattice according to the definition? Is this thing a lattice? Okay, so is it clear, first of all, how the relation is defined by this picture? So for example, in the case of 2, well, maybe let's write it, this thing substitute 2, it consists of which pairs? AC. CD, BD, you say, and what else? AC, CD, BD, and? Sorry? AC, CD, BD, we also have BC, right? And we don't have BC, CD, sorry, this is nonsensical. So, you said CD, no? AC, BD, and BD we already have. Jesus Christ. Okay, let me do it myself. AC, BD, BC and AD. What more? Well, as I said, we don't draw anything which corresponds to reflexivity, so AA, CC, BB, DD. We also should put all the pairs that obtained by transitivity, but in this case this is not a problem, right? Let me give names then to this as well, A, B, C, D. Is it clear how this relation is defined here? So your question was what it means for example, for this set, I don't know, A, B, to have an upper bound? We wrote this definition here, right?
No, I need to have its upper bound, but for the means context, should it be contained or?
No, it doesn't, okay, maybe this needs to be made clear, because otherwise, if you insist that this upper bound belongs to the set itself, then actually you wouldn't have any examples of lattices except for chains, right? Okay, cross it out if it is misleading here. So has, Yes, it's maybe indeed confusing. Yes, I understand. You should think three times before you write something in the colloquial way. Right, maybe it was easier after all to write all these definitions painstakingly in purely mathematical fashion. So is it clear now then what, so for example, is it clear what it means for this AB to have an upper bound? Is D, for example, an upper bound of AB in this picture? Why not? Yes. So here actually transitivity plays a role. So we have A, B, B, C, C, D, A, C, A, D, B, D, and all the reflexive pairs, A, B, B, C. You see, this is why we prefer drawing this in this way, right? It's So it's clear then that D is, according to this definition of upper bound, an upper bound of AB. You're still not convinced, Merlin. What's what? Is there still something unclear about this definition? If we mentally delete this it's or okay. Normally, when drawing, so this is another thing that you do when drawing a Hasse diagram of a lattice, you don't draw these arrows. It's always assumed to be upwards. Otherwise, you need to draw arrows. Otherwise, indeed, it's confusing. Okay, no, if you don't, if it's not stated explicitly and if it's not obvious enough, then indeed it's confusing. I agree, yes. Yeah. Now, finally, we are on the same page, or? But you see now that those pictures got a bit, quite a bit more ugly with all these arrows being thrown. And if we have fixed convention that you go upwards, it doesn't really add any information anyway. Good. So, can I return to my original question? Is one a lattice? Yes. Is two a lattice? Why not?
For example, A and B have no least upper bound, or no upper bound at all.
A and B have upper bound. A and B have no lower bound. Yes, so I could actually split this into two examples. One where you have, when you have element with no lower bound, no pair with no lower bound, and another way you have a pair with no upper bound. And here you have actually both instances. So upper is the upper and lower is the lower. That's this thing. Is it a lattice or not? Yes, okay. This thing? We all agree. Just to make sure. Who votes yes? Who votes no? I see some people abstaining. So, what is the least upper bound of A and B? Is it E? The word least suggests that, okay, I should have written explicitly that least is something that is unique, right? So this is not a lattice. There should be always smallest, so least, this is what least means, smallest upper bound among all existing upper bounds. And here those two guys are incomparable, and there is no upper bound better refining those two guys. And similarly, actually, for lower bounds, if you look again at ED, then A is a lower bound, B is a lower bound, but so. And by now it should be already clear how it works with standard examples. So in case of natural, integers, rational, reals, or indeed any chain, so example one here on the blackboard, how does it work? The join of two elements is what? Join is when you go up. The join of two elements is maximum, and the bit of the two elements is minimum. Because it's a chain, every two elements are comparable, so just pick if you want to join the bigger of them, and if you want the meat, you take smaller of them. Divisibility or daring? That's a nice one. Is this a lattice? You remember what it was, right? I'm not sure if I can. No, it didn't. If need be, we can again write it. There exists. So M divides N if there exists K such that M times K is equal to N. Is this a lattice? Do any pair of natural number have least upper bound in this ordering? And greatest lower bound. Those things even have names, right? That we remember from school. I'm not sure about German name, but in English you have quite huge variety of names to choose from. So you have great, you can call it greatest, the greatest lower bound in this ordering, greatest common divisor, greatest common factor, highest common factor, greatest common measure, or highest common divisor. And lowest upper bound is the least common multiple, also known as lowest common multiple or smallest common multiple, so slightly less varied. At least I wasn't able to find more. How about this thing? The most important example for us. What is the join of two subsets? The lowest upper bound of two subsets in this inclusion ordering. It's just their sum, and the mid is their intersection. Well, okay, this is something that is worth mentioning too. So, do partial functions from x to y, where these two things are any subsets, do they form a lattice with this inclusion or specialization ordering between partial functions? Or functions, by the way, because functions are also relations, so we can compare them by... No, sorry, this doesn't make sense, because if you compare them by the graph, then this is very trivial ordering. No two different functions can be comparable, whereas partial functions can. So if two partial functions are defined on a given element of x, but give different values, then they cannot be any upper bound for them. But anyway, this is the only crucial example that we need to keep in mind. And we can, maybe before I go to complete lattices, let us notice then that the notion of lattice in general does not specialize then to does not transfer to relativizations, to restrictions. For example, if you pick just these two elements and with induced order, then they in the domain consisting just of A and B, they have no lower bound and upper bound. So the notion of sublattice in algebraic sense that not correspond is something more than just subposset, let's say. Anyway, let's leave this aside. When you're talking about complete lattices, you insist that every subset, not just a finite one, so not just pair of two elements, but every possible subset has a supremum. Does this mean that every subset has an infimum? So assume, let's state it clearly. Assume every subset has a supremum. Then every subset is an infimum. Why is this? So, given any y, how do I define this? Using the fact that all suprema exist. It should be supremum of some set. Which set? The collection, this must be then the collection of all the lower bounds for Y. Maybe let's. And this is a good exercise in unraveling those definitions to show that this definition does the job. It's a little trivial, in fact. Right. So, what is then the supremum of the empty set? Sorry, the infimum of the empty set. It must be an element of the lattice such that for all y, if y is an element of an empty set, which of course never holds. So this is in fact the top element. This is maybe this is actually more surprising. We should have started with the supremum of the empty set. And this is of course bottom, the smallest element of the lattice. So any complete lattice has bottom element and a top element. So are natural numbers complete lattice? Well, what is the supremum of the set of all natural numbers? A natural number bigger than all natural numbers. I mean, you could define a trivial completion or compactification or whatever, where you add new infinity element or transfinite number, which is above all of them, and that would, of course, give you a complete ordering. But then how about rationals? Again, there is no supremum of the set of all rational numbers. This could be easily fixed, so in the same way. So we could add infinity, plus infinity, minus infinity. Maybe to make it simpler, let us talk about the rational restricted to the 0-1 interval. Is this enough? Does this make rational numbers a complete lattice? Well, how about the supremum of all the elements that are smaller? We are talking about rationals between 0 and 1. Square root of 2 minus 1. Is there smallest rational number greater than all the elements of this set? Well, of course, if there was, then that would be square root of 2 minus 1 itself. So that would mean that this is square root of 2 minus 1 is a rational number. And then all the mathematics that we know since ancient times would simply collapse. So this is, in fact, how you obtain one way of seeing real numbers is that these are rational numbers to which all possible suprema and infima have been added to in a sensible way, without destroying existing suprema and infima, to be more precise. Well, and top and bottom elements, so let's say any closed interval of real numbers. Okay, let's keep this divisibility ordering thing. How about Posset? Is this a complete lattice? Well, you take if you have infinite collection of subsets, and you take the big sum, or in LaTeX, big cap, and big intersection of the whole family, right? And so this gives you trivially infima and suprema, and this is in fact for our purposes, at least for this lecture and the next lecture, the most important example of complete lattice that there is. Again, just to avoid any confusion, it is important to make clear that we understand the business of stability and the relativization of substructure. So I have already shown you that even being a lattice does not necessarily mean that you are stable by passing to any subdomain. Then being a sublattice, even a sublattice, so where all the suprema and infima of finite cells exist, does not mean that you are complete lattice, even if the original lattice was complete, like all the finite subsets of N. They form lattice because sum of a pair of two finite sets is finite, intersection of two finite sets is finite. But things get even more messy. So it can be the case that you have a subposet of a poset such that the original big poset was lattice complete, and the smaller subposet or sublattice is still complete as a lattice. But the suprema and infima, the infinite suprema and infinite infima do not coincide. And one example, natural if you are a mathematician or remember the notion of open and closed subsets of, let's say, reals or rational numbers, is provided precisely by opens or the dually closed. For this you need to take closed sets, and for example of family of sets where all the mids or infima exist, but they do not necessarily coincide with intersection, you can take opens. Why is this the case? We know that the open subset of any topological space are closed under ordinary set theoretical sums. So therefore they form lattice, they are complete as a lattice. And we have already agreed that this means that all the infima must exist again. So we know that there exists in the collection of whatever collection of open subsets we take, there would be always open subset which is greatest among those contained in all of those open subsets. But it doesn't have to be the same thing as it's, as their intersection. Let's say that you think of the following family of open sets. So if you say, I'm taking all the intervals of the form 1 over n, 1 minus 1 over n, say n greater or equal to 3, what is its, well, what is its intersection, set theoretical intersection? Sorry, I should have, it would be better to do this. What would be set theoretical intersection of this thing? Anybody can tell me. This you have seen at school, that's, I'm sure about it. No, come on, what is this thing? If you take intersection over all n, in n, of all such open intervals, so I'm starting with, let's say, I don't know, minus 1/3, 1/3, minus 1/4, 1/4, what am I going to obtain in the end? What is the set of all numbers that belong to all intervals of this form? Anybody? There is nothing unclear about it, right? Yes? Intersection. Exactly, it's the singleton of zero. Is this an open set? Well, is this a sum of open intervals? No, right? So, if you take this thing in the lattice of open set, so open, let's say, then you will obtain empty set. This is the smallest open, the greatest open set which is contained in all of these guys. Well, again, maybe that was, I hope that it clarified thing on the more, I don't know. Let's get quicker to actually fixed point theorems because we're not getting anywhere this way. And Again, in semantics of programming languages, one often needs suprema or infima or bigger collection than just finite sets, but not necessarily all sets. Like, for example, only of directed families of sets, these are called DCPOs, or just countable chains, which is called omega CPO. But again, this is something we don't need in this part of the lecture. But let's forget about dispersal functions. We will have to return to it probably if we do the notational semantics. Anyway, so now let's finally go to the last ingredient that we need to define the notion of a fixed point. So let us think that we have a function that is sending a poset, well, maybe not onto the whole, onto itself, but inside itself. So function whose domain and range are then the poset itself. And now we can define what it means for an element. Well, it can be defining, in fact, without any the notion of ordering. A fixed point of any function is something on which this function stabilizes. Right? This is familiar notion, hopefully. So is it true that any f on a lattice has to have a fixed point? This is really where we're heading to for this one hour, and finally we can. So let's say that I have something like this, and I have a function which goes, so this is a, b, 0, 1. So I have a function which sends a into b, b into a, 0 into 1, and 1 into 0. Clearly it doesn't stabilize, right? There is no fixed point of it. Whichever point you start with, you will always keep infinitely circulating. So that's, of course, a very stupid thing to expect. But how about monotone ones? What does it mean for a function to be monotone? This is actually an important notion for us. F is monotone if for any a b, oh no, I'm using a b rather than v w. If we have that w is contained in v, then we have that f of w is contained in f of v. Sorry, I said contain. I'm already thinking about inclusion ordering. So it's below FV in whatever this order is. So clearly this thing is not monotone, right? Zero is below one, but F of one is not, F of zero is not below F of one. Any chance that I will be able to find a monotone function on this lattice which has no fixed point?
The function sends 0 to a and a to 1, b to 1, and 1 to 1.
And it doesn't have fixed point?
Well, it has 1.
Exactly. So, yeah, so no dice. It looks good, right? The monotone city looks like something that can help us. Oh, right, yeah, we could, of course, make our life more difficult. Let's say that I'm talk about natural numbers. And I think about successor function. This thing is monotone, right? Does it have success? Does it have a fixed point? Of course not, right? And there is no natural number that is equal to successor itself. Unless we add this infinity element on the top. So maybe if we have both top and bottom, then every monotone function will have to have a fixed point. How about this? That's my next proposal. Do I have more chances of succeeding now? You look convinced. Good, good, good. Who is voting yes? Is it true that every monotone function with, can we try to sketch the proof of it? Something like this idea that Merlin had, that if you go high enough, then sooner they will hit one, and maybe even just existence of top is enough. No agreement, no dissent. I mean, this is problem of participating democracy.